This is Donald Hussig with Loving the Earth Environmental Revolution. Joining us today is Dr. William Sook. Dr. Sook works for the National Institute of Environmental Health Sciences. Good morning, Dr. Sook.
Good morning. How are you doing?
Pretty good. Very, very pleased to have this opportunity. The persistent organic pollutants have been right at the very center of the work that Cancer Action New York does. I have to say that I love talking to people about them, and so I'm sure that this will be a great opportunity to experience some more of these really good vibe feelings that people have. Thank you for granting me the opportunity to talk to you about this. You've given me one interview before. It was a great interview, and I'm really looking forward to this. So just give the listeners a little bit of your background, and then we'll just go into the detail.
Okay. I am with the National Institute of Environmental Health Sciences. It's an institute of the National Institutes of Health. I have essentially two positions. One is director of the Center for Risk and Integrated Sciences, and the other is director of the Superfund Research Program. And I have been director of that program for for 25 years, except for an 18-month stint as acting deputy director of this institute. And I don't know, if I have a PhD in microbiology from GW and a master's in public health and health policy from UNC. Is that enough?
Yes, that's, okay. You're well educated, and you have had a lot of experience in using your education. Let's talk about the persistent organic pollutants. These are chemicals that include dioxins and brominated flame retardants, PCBs, the pesticides, which are lipophilic, including the old DDT, and then some more recent chemicals, such as toxaphene and Myrex, and then there's the hexachlorocyclohexane. There you go. Well, almost didn't get that one out. It's a lot of chemicals, and they have long, difficult names, and the public doesn't know much about this, but some progress is being made on changing that and having the public become more and more knowledgeable. A report was published in 2010 by the World Health Organization. Its title is Persistent Organic Pollutants, Impact on Child Health. And I've used that report so many times now during the course of the past, say, couple years, to educate local policymakers about the POPs exposure health hazard, and it's working good. That document is so powerful. It's only 58 pages. It's got a really strong recommendation of minimizing the exposure that children receive to POPs. So let's go back to before this report was created. What happened that brought us to the stage of the National Institute of Environmental Health Sciences here in the U.S., funding a World Health Organization report on the subject of the persistent organic pollutants, the exposure that children receive, and the health effects of exposure?
Okay. Let me just answer that in a few different ways. One is that there has been a fair amount of research over the years on persistent organic pollutants, not only in this country, but elsewhere in the world. I got involved, and I feel that the genesis for this report started back in 2002. There was a large international conference, the first international conference of its kind, entitled International Conference on Environmental Threats to the Health of Children, Hazards and Vulnerability, that's the full title. And I was the honorary WHO chair for that conference. And during that conference, there was a paper that was produced from that conference with broad authorship that appeared in EHP, Environmental Health Perspectives, within a year. Matter of fact, I'm going to say the latter part of 2002, October 2002, thereabouts. I can give you the reference later on if you need. But about around that time, about 6 months after that conference, a group of us got together, also in Thailand. I might mention that the meeting was held at the Chulalongkorn Research Institute in Bangkok, Thailand, and a small workshop that was held to look at some of the recommendations that came out of that meeting was also held in Thailand about 6, 9 months later. And at that meeting, at this workshop, we broke up into different groups, and we looked at, for example, we looked at air pollution, indoor air pollution from biomass burning, outdoor air pollution from auto exhaust, et cetera. We looked at groundwater primarily from the standpoint of arsenic, high levels of arsenic exposure in groundwater. And one of the areas that was under discussion was POPs. And you have to realize, too, that the original intent of the conference and the workshop looked at children and their vulnerability to exposure to a variety of agents. And then when we broke up into this workshop, we started looking at these areas of interest. And frankly, there was not a lot of traction for POPs at that time. And one of the reasons I feel is because even though there was, there's two reasons, I think. Even though there was a fair amount of research that has already taken place over time, POPs is not a single agent, okay? It's not arsenic. It is a number of different agents. I mean, you've listed them already before. I don't have to go through that again. So it's hard for people to actually put their finger on it. The other part of it had to do with the fact that we were looking primarily at exposure of agents in children and what data were available to support the understanding that a particular agent or agent is leading to a disease, a disorder, a dysfunction. And you can do that, for example, with dioxin, okay? But it's more difficult to do that with some of the other POPs. So I think that over time, from the past 10 years, or in the case of the report coming out in 8 years, there had to be a critical mass, if you will, there had to be a sufficient knowledge base so that people could actually write about it. And I will tell you that the driving force behind this, after a while, were initially Terry Dempster from WHO, followed by Jenny Prontzek from WHO. And they were, you need to have leadership in children's health, and in this case, children's health with regards to exposure to POPs. So that's how we got to this point. I think that answers your question. Does that? Okay.
Well, maybe not fully.
Okay.
There must have been some inter-U.S., you know, there must have been some within the U.S., say, governmental health infrastructure. There must have been some growing concern about POPs and the willingness to invest, you know, U.S. taxpayers' dollars. You know, NIH, EHS funded the POP, WHO POPs report. Can you tell us just a little bit about, say, how the U.S. was looking at this, you know, how our national government was viewing the POPs, and, you know, how they were willing to let the, you know, have the NIEHS spend U.S. taxpayers' dollars on this report?
Well, okay. You have to realize that the NIEHS, as an institute of NIH, 80, off the top of my head, at least at NIH, 85% of all money that supports research, that we have supports research, okay? Whether it's with the National Cancer Institute, whether it's with the National Institute of Heart, Lung, and Blood Institute, or whatever, okay? So as a research organization, as an organization that supports research in primarily in the extramural community, primarily in the United States, it is our job, it is our mission to support research in a variety of areas. If you go back, persistent organic pollutants have been around for a very long time. I think that my earliest recollection is of a paper that was produced, it was back in the 1960s or thereabouts, on thyroid function. I don't even remember exactly who the author was, frankly. But there has been a body of knowledge and a body of information that has that has supported the foundation for being able to look at why a particular persistent pollutant might have an effect on perinatal exposure. Or, and to tell you the truth, my recollection too is that a lot of the earlier work was actually done on wildlife or on ecological systems and not necessarily on human systems. Okay, except where there was a high level of exposure where it was very obvious that the exposure caused a significant problem. Okay,
exactly.
For example, oil disease, Yu Chang in children perinatally exposed to PCBs, that was published a number of years ago, 20 years ago. This was a high level of exposure, so there was a definite indication that this was the cause and effect. The cause and effect for chemicals such as PCBs, for example, is usually very, the exposures are usually less, and therefore the effects are much more subtle. Wildlife or ecological systems are very good markers or indicators of a problem. So what I'm getting at is you have to have, one needs to have a body of information, a body of knowledge in a variety of systems before you begin to look at things in a much more focused and directed strategic way. I like to think that this particular report that was put up by WHO in 2010 will enable not just NIEHS, but other organizations worldwide to look at these kinds of exposures, again, primarily in children, but also in mothers who are women who are pregnant, for example, and look at the effect on in utero exposure as well, which is an area that's not really looked at very much.
Okay, so there is a report titled "Persistent Organic Pollutants' Impact on Child Health,"
mm-hmm.
and we've gotten to the stage of now it being funded and the report. I don't think we'll spend any time on the actual details of the creation of the report. If you could just give us like a real thumbnail sketch of the creation of the report, and if not, we can just go right on to your takeaway from the report.
This report was put together. Well, first of all, this report was put together through a cooperative agreement mechanism that we had with the World Health Organization. This has been a long-standing cooperative agreement with the intent on pulling together researchers in the world to look at specific issues and areas of concern, and in this case, put together a report. I might mention too that this report didn't happen de novo. Okay, there were a lot or a number of similar type reports that focused on either children's health or that looked at, I'm talking about large reports, that looked at other types of problems or issues. I mean, the one that jumps at mind is that in 2002, Terry Dampster put out one that looked at endocrine disruption. That was also a WHO report, and it's cited in this particular document as well. But that looked at endocrine disrupting chemicals, of which persistent organic pollutants, some of them are, or in, depending on the where they're, how they're, depending on the kind of exposure, can be. So there's, you know, there's always been a firm basis for putting together a report like this. I mean, the European Union has put out one. UNEP has done some absolutely wonderful work. United Nations Environmental Program has done some actually incredible work on looking at persistent organics and that go back quite a few years, actually. But again, they're looking mostly, although not totally, from the standpoint of its effect on ecological systems,
okay,
for the most part. Anyway.
Okay. Let's go now to you are a scientist. You have a lot of experience with both government and research. What is your conclusion? You know, lots of people just wonder, well, is this report valid? I've actually encountered those who say it is not valid, and I quickly point out that it is valid, and we discuss this. But, you know, first of all, it's always useful to just take a position upon, you know, I'm sure you're going to say this is valid, but, you know, just for the record, you know, just for the people that are listening and wondering, well, you know, what does he really think about it? You know, there's always, people are complicated, and I'd just like for you to just give us your response, your expert and well-seasoned, well-prepared to make a call, give a call on, you know, the validity and the substance, and, you know, just how great a report this is or how,
mm-hmm.
you know, just what kind of report is this?
Okay. Well, first of all, it's a report that tries and I think does a good job of capturing the body of literature and therefore the body of information. And therefore, you know, is important in increasing our knowledge base, okay? The more information that we have on anything, and in this case, persistent organics, and especially persistent organics in children, the better we are in order to minimize those exposures. And in some cases, if, you know, develop intervention methods to reduce exposures to improve people's health. Now, you're asking my opinion about, you know, does it do everything for everybody? No. It is intended to provide people with a better understanding as to where we are. It's a sort of a state of the art,
okay,
type of a paper, and to provide some kind of a direction as to what we need to do next, or what things we need to do next in order to make sure that that we address some of these issues. There are, you know, again, I go back to the fact that, you know, we are an Institute of the National Institutes of Health. Our job is to redress research needs and research and provide research support where there are gaps. And I think that the recommendations that are made in this document are fine. There's nothing wrong with them. Some of them are a little bit broad-based and have a whole world of their own. For example, the impact of climate change on exposure to pups. That's a whole other document and unto itself. So it's not intended to address that issue per se. But looking at the relationship between perinatal exposure or childhood exposure and disease outcomes, okay. The one issue that's been of interest to me, which is not really is not addressed in this report, and that's because it wasn't intended to, but it's implied in this report, and that has to do with, as a matter of fact, it's more than implied, but it doesn't come out and say it, is looking at early life exposures and the development of diseases later in life, such as, well, they do mention breast cancer specifically, but there are other types of cancers. There are other types of cardiovascular diseases. There are neurological issues that are associated with exposure that may not show up in kids when they're 7 or 8 or even a teenager, but they may show up in young adults or even adults or even in the elderly later
right.
on. And that's not, you know, but the report was not intended to do all of that.
Okay.
So I think it's a good report.
Okay.
And if I have to, I would say that, you know, from my perspective and having been involved in supporting research for most of my professional career, I would say that we, meaning not just NIEHS, but we in the global community need to be able to continue to address the problems associated with POPs and also to provide support for more, better, and defined research.
Right. So tell me now, this is very interesting to me because there are so many different angles to this and so many different things that could be discussed that are very relevant to public health and science and disease and exposure. The one particular thing that I'm thinking about right this minute is this matter of, okay, there's a time for research, and you know, in this thing of like, how do you decide how much money to say spend on research as opposed to getting the message out that the research has already elucidated? And so, let's talk some now about am I correct in seeing both a guidance coming from this report on doing more research, and in addition to that, a guidance on taking concrete actions that would make use of what is known from the previous research to minimize the exposure that children receive these chemicals. See what I mean?
Yeah, I understand. You know, it's what you're hitting upon is very important, and that is that it's more than just, you're right, it's more than just doing research, but it's also more than just providing education to health professionals and public health people, okay? They need to have the best tools available to them so that they can understand what the potential problems might be, okay? So it is we need to approach not just POPs, but, and not just the impact of agents on children, but we need to look at the entire area of environmental public health and environmental health science research in a much more integrated way. Just to use an example that I'm familiar with, and that is the Superfund program, the Superfund research program that I've been running for a long time, does things in a very integrated way. We are looking at it from we are looking at environmental exposures. We're also looking at ways to reduce those exposures, either through remediation means or through other kinds of mitigation or intervention, by working with engineers and working with geochemists, but also working with epidemiologists and molecular biologists. Okay, because environmental health is very broad in its appreciation of what it does. But it also needs to be able to provide the research, the research data and the information and the knowledge that comes from that research needs to find its way into the hands of people who can be able to use that information and make informed decisions in order to improve the health and well-being, in this case, of kids.
Right.
So it's not just one or the other.
Yes, I see this. I have noticed one thing. As far as one thing that I find to be somewhat lacking in that report, I love that report. It's according to, you know, according to me, you know, in my mind, it is the best report that's ever been written as far as doing something to use scientific knowledge to protect public health. It's very powerful. It's very well done. It's I love it. But the one thing that I find to be somewhat less than what I would like it to be totally would be it doesn't seem to have a whole lot of emphasis on direct education of the individual mom and dad, baby, you know, boy and girl. You know, once kids are like in sixth grade, they certainly can't understand something of this nature, of this, you know, this subject type of area. There doesn't seem to be the focus. It talks about regulating, you know, making regulatory changes such as banning the feeding of waste animal fat to food animals. This would certainly make a big difference in the POPs exposures of children. It would be a major step toward minimization of exposure. And then it talks about educating physicians about this matter of the clear connection between exposure to POPs, you know, the collective exposure to POPs and diseases like cancer and diabetes and heart disease and, you know, a whole litany, a whole spectrum of diseases. But it doesn't just say we need to just tell people the basic non-expert, the members of the general public. It doesn't say let's just tell them about this. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm. Well,
is that a window on the way it is with every matter of public health? It just seems to me. See, I look at public health a lot, and I just stand back and look at it from all different directions, and I'm always feeling like, but they just don't quite do this thing of just telling people, you know, just basically providing, like, say the state of California published a health hazard advisory on diesel engine exhaust a long, long time ago. You know, I saw that thing, like, it must be 10, you know, 15 years old by now, a long time ago. And I just always kind of feel like, you know, when are they going to publish a health hazard advisory on POPs or something else, you know, say arsenic or lead or you know, anything?
Well, you know, there is a section in here that talks about protection of children and communities from exposure. You're right. It's not a long section. It doesn't provide there's not a level of granularity about some of the things that it does. It makes some broad recommendations with regards to minimizing exposures of, you know, don't eat this food and don't eat that food and, you know.
Well, see, that'd be fantastic
if they're putting
that message out to people.
You're talking about,
you know,
something a little bit different, I think. Okay, this report was intended to be to go out there for people to look at and to hopefully use. Okay,
was it intended for consumption by the public?
Excuse me.
Was it intended to be read and acted upon by the public or by the scientists and the, you know, the regulators?
Well, I think it was designed to be read by three groups of people, okay? Designed to be read by people who are in the research community so that they can look at this and address some of the research gaps that
yes.
need to be addressed. I think it was designed also to provide information to the public health community. In other words, people within schools of public health whose job it is to improve the health of their state, community, whatever. Okay?
Yep.
And I think that the third audience probably was, I like to think anyway, it was also policy from a departmental standpoint, not just in the United States, but elsewhere in the world, to look at it from the standpoint, are there some regulatory or are there some policy changes that we would consider making in the future? Okay.
Sure.
Those are the three audiences that
okay.
I think it was designed to hit, basically.
Okay.
And I think it did.
It does
a good job
it
on
does.
Each one of them.
But
I think
that,
it, you know, huh?
Yeah, considering that, do you see now then, is it reasonable to conclude, you know, based upon what you're saying and what, you know, I've been saying, that it would be a worthy endeavor to create something from that document that was intended for public reading and understanding so that, you know, we could be actually making use of all the abilities of all the people out there, you know, to, you know, the parent could just say, well, now I understand this. I'm just going to talk to my kid about it and we will cut back on the hamburger and hot dogs, you know, just them doing it. You know, see what I'm getting at? It's them doing it rather than the scientists. You know, good, the scientists are doing it. Good, the policy people are doing it. Good, the regulators are doing it. You know, ban the feeding of waste animal fat to food animals. But at the same time, it's also good that the parents and the kids will all be working together with the scientists and the regulators to, as quickly as possible, minimize the exposure.
Well, you know,
so would it be possible to get a document? Do you think there, in the future there might be a document that just kind of takes this down to the level of the general public as far as, you know, what's – and I don't think it would have to go down much. I truly don't think it has to go down at all, truly. I use it just to educate the general public. I guess it's a little long, you know, how many people are going to
read
58
pages. Well,
you know,
I'm not sure that – okay, and I don't know if this is – I'm not sure that parts of this have not been used by schools of public health and other –
okay.
Community organizations and groups, frankly. I know that a lot of the things that we produce at NIEHS are co-opted, if you will, are used by community groups. Now, you have to also realize that, you know, in the United States, we have a fairly good network of community-based organizations that can take this information, that can work, that work with researchers in an academic organization to help reword some documents to allow for the broader community to appreciate that, to appreciate what's in them. I'm not sure how that is in other parts of the world.
Okay.
And I just don't know.
Sure.
I mean, in some parts of the world, I do know. Okay. In other parts of the world, I don't. I do know that, for example, in certain countries in South America, Argentina and Chile, for example, there's a very good network of community-based organizations that can take this information. I know that Thailand is very good at that. I also think that there's unevenness in the United States as to that sort of thing, but I think for the most part we do a reasonably good job.
I have a question about
this. But, you know, I'm not sure. Yeah, go ahead.
I have a question about superfund sites, because see, right in that report, it specifies, it says this minimization, it's kind of like it prioritizes the actions for minimization so that one, you know, they clearly state in the report that it will be good to do the minimization work for the communities at risk, you know, the places where there's been more exposure in the past and continuing exposure now. And, you know, they make this difference between the background levels of POPs exposure, and we got to get into that too, you know. There's just so much here. The point of that report being that even at background levels of exposure for the whole world, this is something that needs to be minimized, let alone these places where they have been the excess exposures, say the POPs contaminated Superfund sites, mm-hmm. or the sites over Vietnam, those hot spots where the Agent Orange happened to, you know, get into the environment at the airports like Da Nang and Phuket. Many, many places around the world where there's this excess specific source of POPs exposure and ongoing exposures and past exposures, because they're all relevant because it's a lifetime of exposure that's, you know, and generations of exposure, really, that are being considered here. It's quite a matter, the exposure, the length of time that's relevant in the exposure and the health of the here and now. My point is this. My question is this. It's not a point. It's a question. Have you been, are you aware, in having your, you've got a great position here with the role on the Superfund. Because, see, this, I'm very interested in this. I've contacted the people who are knowledgeable in EPA on the Hudson River Superfund site, and it's their conclusion. You know, this is what they tell me. They say
No education has taken place on POPs collectively. The part of the story that we convey to the populations that reside in the vicinity of the Hudson River Superfund site is limited to the chemicals that are there, the PCBs in this case, and the exposures that occur because of that site, the fish, the drinking water, you know, whatever. But it's only those chemicals there. They don't tell them the part of the story that this POPs report covers of the contamination of the global mainstream food supply with PCBs and bromine flame retardants and dioxins and hexachlorocyclohexane and DDT and myrix and toxaphene. They don't tell them that. And that's the most, that's the part of the iceberg that's under the water, the tip of the iceberg, you know, that you see and warns you about the iceberg under the water. People don't get it. The public is not aware of this at all, you know. Those ladies down there with the Hudson River Superfund site, these EPA, this Mary Olson and this Larissa Romanowski, you know, those people will actually, and we were talking about the Hudson River Superfund site, we were talking about the Grass River Superfund site, we're talking about these St. Lawrence River Superfund sites, and I talked to people up in the state of Michigan where there's this Tetuobasi River Superfund site with the Dow dioxin contamination. I talked to people down in Nitro, West Virginia, where there's the former Monsanto facility that had a dioxin problem with the Kanawha River. And in all these instances, the end of the story is the public has no knowledge, and they have not been provided any knowledge from any entity that they're aware of, you know, whether it be a county public health department or a state public health department or the EPA or the CDC, that no message has gone out yet to people that live around Superfund sites concerning the message that's in that WHO POPs report of being this health hazard of POPs exposure, you know, total POPs exposure that comes from food supply contamination and consumption of the contaminated mainstream food supply. Mm. What's your view on that?
I'm okay. That was a very long question.
I know it.
Okay, I'm trying to.
Sorry about that. I got excited on that one.
That's okay. I think that there are two things that jump out at me when you in your question. One is the fact that if I'm reading it right, if I'm hearing it right, it's you're right. It is more than just POPs exposure. There are other things that people are exposed to. You mentioned the Superfund site in upstate New York that's primarily PCBs. Yes, there's all kinds of other stuff in there. Okay.
Well, I mean that. I'm not getting to that. I'm just getting at this thing of, like, you tell them about the PCBs that are coming from that site, whether it's respiratory, you know, they tell them about the respiratory. They didn't used to tell them that. They tell them now about the consumption of the fish from the river and the breathing of the PCBs that evaporate from the contaminated sediments or soils, whatever the case may be. But they totally leave out this whole message about the PCBs and the dioxins and the flame retardants and all those old pesticides and some not-so-old pesticides all being in the mainstream food supply that they're putting on the table every day when they've already had that excess exposure to those other chemicals plus that exposure they had before they knew about it to these chemicals in the food that they're putting on the table. This is what I'm trying to get at. That POPs report is so powerful. It should be used in the case of these contaminated communities first to do this thing of telling the people, the individual kids and their parents and the people that run the schools and put the school lunches on the table and all this, that these people that live in these places, the Hudson River Valley where the PCB exposure took place, the St. Lawrence River Valley where the PCB and dioxin exposure took place, the, you know, all the Kanawha River Valley down there in West Virginia where the dioxin exposure took place, the Tetuobasi and the Saginaw, you know, basically in that situation, it's Midland County downwind from Dow and Bay County downstream from Dow there in the state of Michigan, hundreds of thousands of people, you know, that need to be told what's known by the scientists and has been published in that WHO POPs report way back in 2010, and yet they do not know this. I talked to the media people, the news media people. I talked to the public health people right there, this in Michigan there. That I'd say that was the place that I'd happen first if it's going to happen in the U.S. First, Midland County and Bay County, Michigan. This Mike Krasick is the public health commissioner for the Midland County Public Health Department. This Mary Dykema, I think her name is with the Michigan Community Health Department entity. And Mary said to me, it is not our job to educate on the POPs exposures of these people. We have a mandate. We get it from the Superfund. And our mandate is to educate upon the chemical of concern in this particular place, and that's dioxin coming from the Titobasi. And we educate about the turkeys that have dioxins in them. We educate about the deer that have dioxins in them. We educate about the fish that have dioxins in them. We educate about the respiratory exposures where people breathe dioxins from this plume that was coming from Dow for so very long. And yet they're leaving out the part of the story that they could do the most about now, which is just tell people, well, the dioxin and the PCBs and the flame retardants are in the pork that you just bought and you put on your table and you fed your kids last night. You know, that is the biggest hit, you know, the biggest, the lowest hanging, truly, and the juiciest and best fruit, you know, that could be picked right now as far as the science and the minimization. I like to think about minimizing the harm that can result from the contamination of the environment with these chemicals. And in my mind, that is the most effective action that could be taken. Just tell the parents and the kids that these chemicals are in the mainstream food supply. Jimmy?
Well, I can't not agree with you. I mean, that makes perfect sense. I think the question becomes, I still think that there are a couple of issues here that you raise. One has to do with multiple exposures over time, okay,
yep.
And the burden of those exposures, in this case on children who are essentially developing organisms as they are growing between, you know, zero and, shall we say, 6 years old. And the levels of exposure and the load, if you will, of these exposures on that individual, those individuals, and what effect it's having, maybe not have an effect on them for a variety of reasons while they're still children, but may have an effect on them when they're older. As far as the information flow, I think that is an opportunity for state and local health departments, as well as the Center for Disease Control, for example, just using those, as well as schools of public health, to be able to inform the public about what the potential harm is to these kinds of exposures. And the potential for progression to disease. One of the things that we have tried over the years, or we've not tried, we one of the things that we have supported as far as research is concerned, is the development or the understanding the link between an environmental exposure or exposures, which I'll get to in a second, and disease etiology. And if you understand those links, or that link, assuming that it's linear, then you can develop prevention intervention methods to reduce that exposure, either at the front end, if you look at it in linear, or somewhere along the line to slow the progression of the disease, especially if it's later in life. But I think you're also mentioning the fact that the exposure to mixtures or combined exposures of chemicals and other types of stresses could create a significant disease burden on an individual. And the question, you know, from a research standpoint, we have struggled, frankly, with trying to get a better understanding of exposure to mixtures and what the overall health consequences are to those particular exposures. That ain't easy. Okay, there's no other way of saying it. That doesn't necessarily mean that it's not possible. It just means that it requires a substantial amount of effort and resources into understanding exposure to mixtures at the same time that's happening during, shall we say, preconception, during pregnancy, and in early childhood. So you're looking at it from a temporal standpoint. You're looking at it from a time standpoint.
Yep.
None of this is easy. That doesn't necessarily mean that the public should not be informed. They should be.
Yes. Yeah, and so I guess my point is this. Now that the science has accumulated to the point where it was possible to produce that guidance document for the research scientists, for the, you know, the policy people, for the public health community, isn't that report relevant to, and wouldn't it be good to provide that directly to the people that live around these POPs contaminated sites so they could jump in and do the, you know, we have to agree, I'm sure you would agree that the quickest thing that could be done, you know, once that information were to be conveyed to everybody, you know, all the people that are involved here, that then the parent could just say, okay, I'm not bringing home any more hot dogs, I'm not bringing home any more hamburgers. And see, I don't think we need to study anymore what the effect of all those chemicals in those products would be, because that POPs report has already said, it already said hot dogs and hamburger are a big source of exposure to POPs, and it's clear that POPs impose a significant amount of harm. You know, that there is a significant POPs exposure health hazard. See what I mean? You know, I just kind of think, I always think, what is the most we could do that would have the fastest result in the most critical situations, such as these POPs contaminated sites like the Titobasi and the Hudson and the St. Lawrence and the Grass?
You know, I agree with you. I mean, the point is that two things. One is that, yes, that information is available and it needs to be fashioned in a way that people can understand it and appreciate it. And do it in an informed, as I said, appreciative way. The other, and again, as an institute of NIH, and I hate to keep saying that over and over again, but as an institute of NIH, the information that is provided to people needs to be based upon good, sound, scientific knowledge and understanding.
Exactly.
And
that POPs report, that's all good, sound, scientific knowledge and understanding.
Yeah.
So I'm just thinking we're ready. I'm going to stop making noises here and just say words. Do you feel, you know, in your expert position, do you feel that WHO POPs report is ready for being presented to the people that live around these POPs contaminated sites so they could get involved in reducing their exposures to the point of minimization?
It's public information. I don't see why they shouldn't have that.
Yeah, like
anybody with a, but
see, they don't know about it. They don't know about it. There needs to be something more needs to be done. I feel strongly that government, in having been given the role as the protector of the public health, that's the way people look at it. And so, see, I run into this all the time.
You're dealing with a different issue here. Okay,
right.
You're dealing with the ability to be able to inform people in as close to real time or near time as possible. And I do think that in this day and age, that's not really an issue. It just requires an organization, in this case WHO, to more widely disseminate that information and to make it known. I'm not picking on WHO. I just think that that's part of what they do. I also think
So for the future, your thinking is that the way these people live in Michigan and the way these people in New York, the actual individual people, you know, the mom and the dad that are eating the chemicals in the food and have already had these exposures and have already experienced some of these diseases in their community and even their own bodies, that are caused by the industrial chemicals in the Superfund sites, it's your belief that the WHO will get on this and educate those people so they know about this report.
That's good.
It'd be fantastic if they would do that. That would solve the whole problem. You know, people would have, we'd have everybody working together to minimize exposure as quickly as possible. And that's it.
Yeah. Okay.
Okay. Let's see now. I think I had one more question. Oh yeah. Let's just kind of like just
got
look back
minute.
At this. Okay. Let's look back at this. What are the diseases that you would say? You know, see, a lot of people, you know, people haven't read this yet, and I want to get their attention on this. What diseases could they take a big chunk out of risk on, you know, just do something certainly significant in reducing their risk of getting the disease that are associated with POPs exposure?
What one thing could they do?
No, what one thing? What diseases? You know, what does it say in the WHO POPs report? What diseases do they say
this will help with, if people know about this, if action's taken on to minimize exposure?
Well, there are a number of birth-related defects associated with POPs exposures. There's also a potential for reducing breast cancer, specifically hormonally related cancers such as breast cancer, and I would assume prostate cancer. I know that there's some issues with regards to neurological exposure to PCBs specifically. It's very similar to lead exposure in children in that it reduces, there's a diminution in IQ, for example, associated with PCB exposures. I think that that's probably, you know, a good start. I think, you know, there's issues with regards to cardiovascular disease as well, associated with POPs exposure.
Yep, and type 2 diabetes. Yep, that's
yeah,
it.
Okay. Type 2, yeah, okay.
That's it. Well, you've done a great job for us. Thank you very much for this fantastic interview.
Okay, well, good luck. Take care, Donald. Take care. Talk to you later.
Yes, thank you very much.
Bye-bye now.
This has been Donald Hussig with Loving the Earth Environmental Revolution, and we are doing it. The people are building a revolution in environmental health. Gone are the days when it's just, we're going to research this more, we're going to study this more. The day has come when the WHO is getting into this, the National Institute of Environmental Health Sciences is getting into this, the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention are getting into this. We're all working together now to minimize the POPs exposure that children receive, that women of childbearing age receive. We're going to get this done. The days of brushing the issue of industrial chemical exposure and disease outcome under the rug, hiding it from the people, they're over. The people in no time, the people, the moms and dads and the children, the people will know about industrial chemical exposure and disease outcome, and they'll have all the information, including the big information about the food supply contamination with these industrial chemicals. The people will know this, many of them, in ever-increasing numbers very soon. That's a promise. It's been Donald Hussig with Loving the Earth Environmental Revolution. Good day.